afternoon. I noticed that somebody let me know when time's up. Hi everyone, my name is Brent and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi Brent.
Welcome to the meeting. Thanks for asking me to speak. I consider it a pleasure and an honor to speak at this particular meeting because when I arrived in Montreal in November, December of 99, I'd had a few years without drink, but it was a very white-knuckled sobriety. And the first group that I connected with and became a member of was this group when it was downtown. And many of the faces were different, and they've since moved on, but it's still Sunday nighters. And I'm happy to see new faces come, faces that I know from other meetings, keeping the meeting alive and thriving. And I'm very happy to see the new location. It appears to be working out well, and I wish the meeting all the best. I'm also very excited by the technology. This meeting is online, and you can access previous speakers online, and I've tried it. And I heard voices from people that I hadn't seen in years, and I was able to listen to their share, and I loved it. It felt great. So I think it's a wonderful use of technology and very sober and very AA, so I applaud you for it. I'd like to share with you a little something that happened to me just about a month ago that kind of illustrates the way AA appears to be working in my life these days. But for the grace of God, this coming January, I have not had a drink in 8 years, which is truly a miracle. A month ago, I play the bagpipes, and I play for a band that does some traveling, and it's connected to the military. And I mention all this because pipe bands and soldiers tend to drink a lot. And this group that I travel with is no exception. And we were off to Edmonton, Alberta for a week for a fairly high, you know, high-profile engagement. And we were treated fairly well, which in pipe band terms means we were given a lot of liquor. And I'm traveling with about 15 guys, part of a mass of about a couple hundred, most of whom are soldiers, most of whom are fairly young. All of them, as far as I could tell, drink extremely heavily. So I'm traveling with these guys. This isn't the first time that I've traveled with them, and I knew I had to get to a meeting at some point. But for the week I was there, the first few days, they worked us hard, morning, afternoon, and evening. And I just didn't have time to get to a meeting. I brought the big book, tried to pray, did the best I could, but I was getting resentful. And the resentment that I had was against my friends who were drinking heavily. Why am I pissed off? Well, they're hurting themselves. I'm upset because I guess there's a part of me that maybe feels that they seem to be having a lot of fun. Maybe I can't have that same kind of fun anymore. What's going on? And that kind of thinking is alcoholic thinking. Oh, I can only have a good time if I'm drinking like them. That's crazy. And towards the end of that week, on a Friday night, our band, we were staying in a university residence. And the floor that we were on, my band decided to host all the other pipe bands, or about four or five other, for a whiskey tasting evening. Because apparently single malt scotch is significantly cheaper in Alberta than it is here. It's about $10 or $15, maybe $20 a bottle cheaper. So every guy in the band bought one a different kind. You know, for some people this is like fine wine, right? The taste and smell is different. You look at the label, this is from Inverness, and it was made with peat and oak casks, yada, yada. So they got this, like first-class scotch filling a table, and all these soldiers and pipers start filing into the room. And why am I there? Well, according to the big book, in these kinds of environments, if I have good business or social reasons for being there, and I'm reasonably on the beam, meaning I'm sober and in my program, I can stay. If I start to feel edgy, I should get out. My bedroom was just a few doors down. I could duck out if I had to. So I thought I'd stay. My buddy, who was running this evening, decides, and I had no idea he was going to do this, what if, and this is all like hardened soldiers, right? He says, what if we all go around the circle and introduce ourselves and describe a little bit about ourselves? And so it starts to go around the circle, and it gets to one fellow who's, you know, 25 years in the Army. He's airborne. He's been, like, 5 tours of duty. He's got rows of medals. He stands up and he goes, hi, my name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. And and he's absolutely right. And it's, you know, it's got a while before it gets around the circle of me, and I'm like, oh my God. But it was actually quite nice. People were sharing about themselves. I thought, this is really delightful. And it gets around to this older fella that I'd seen around, older meaning like he's more than 70, possibly even 80, still piping away. And I knew nothing about him, but I'd seen him around, and he gets, it's his turn, says, hi, my name is Len, and you might notice that I'm not drinking. That's because I'm an alcoholic in recovery, and I'm 25 years without a drink. And the room erupts. They are ecstatic. They're just, yay! And it turns out this guy is a former commanding officer of a Highland Regiment out in the West, the Calgary Highlanders, graduate of the Royal Military College, airborne himself, yada yada, could like, need all the things that hardcore soldiers need to see in order to respect you, but he's 25 years sober. And I was just one of those moments where, my God. Three or four people later, it's my turn. And I say, hello everyone, my name is Brent, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm almost 8 years without a drink. And he looks at me, and I look at him, and it's just one of those understandings. Whoa, has this been a tough week or what? So we just kind of quietly stepped aside while they kept partying, and we connected, and he says, you know what, I got to get to a meeting. I said, you know what, I got to get to a meeting. So we made plans right there to go to a meeting the next day. He's a little older, so he needed help. That got me out of myself. I had to plan the bus route to get to the meeting. We got there a little early. I had to help take care of him. It got me out of myself, and already I had that feeling of, you know, that weight that lifts when you're thinking of somebody else. That happened. So the medicine was starting already, you know. And we go to this meeting, and it's a discussion meeting, and it's lively, and it's in one of those, there's a lot of clubhouses in Edmonton. There's one of these places that had like 15 meetings in a week. Very popular. And so it's thriving, all kinds of ages, lots of women in the meeting, which I think is a healthy sign. All ages, backgrounds, Aboriginal folk, the whole bit, just, and the topic of discussion was the 11th step. And we connected. And I was able to finish the trip on a lighter, I would say more sober note than when I started. And I would say throughout, including at the beginning when things were a little darker and more painful, my higher power was there throughout. But that moment of my buddy deciding to have a kind of discussion meeting at a whiskey tasting contest, culminating in this old timer introducing himself, it was just fantastic. And these kinds of moments are there. And when you're sober, I find. So, after that, how about I shift gears and go into my story. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. What it was like. Well, I'm 34, turning 35 years of age. I can say that comfortably now. Wasn't always the case. I grew up in southwestern Ontario, and my father, who was German-Irish, and a cop, provincial police, bit of a hard-ass, specialist in weapons and the use of force, and pretty macho, and he drank, but I never knew this. He didn't seem to drink at home, ever. I only found out 2 years ago, he finally came clean and said, you know all those mornings where I was sleeping in bed and your mom told you to be quiet because I had been working shift work the night before, so please be quiet? He says, I was hungover. I was drunk. Which would make sense because his parents were full-blown alcoholics and didn't care who knew and died from alcohol-related illness and smoking and led nasty, brutish, short lives. My mother's side of the family, her father was a soldier as well, and became an engineer. And she was from England, and her mother had survived the Blitz, and alcohol, of course, was used as a way to cope with a lot of that. My mother doesn't drink, apparently doesn't seem to need to, but her sister does, and her father apparently did. So in her case, I think it kind of skipped a generation. For me, I was one of those, you know, I was a lonely kid, and it was I have a younger sister. It was a bit of a rough home, and we were socially, you know, inept. It was a small town, and there were only so many cops, so I was the son of the town sheriff, basically. So it was a bit isolated, and my mother was prone to paranoia, and you know, perhaps a touch of schizophrenia, I don't know. but she's certainly paranoid. So the curtains were often shut, the door was shut down, and we were to stay put. An image came to me while I was being introduced. I'm shifting sponsors, and he's very, let's keep it with the steps, and I'm becoming reacquainted with the steps in a way that I didn't know before, and it feels very good. One of the reasons that I feel that I resisted the steps is because I feared that it was going to be like a leash on me, or I was going to be choked by the steps, that it was going to be limiting and it was going to put me in a box. To discipline me, my parents, when I was a kid, used to, among other things, apparently it was very common at the time, there was a little like harness that they used to put on me that as a hyper kid, with a leash, and you know they needed that to kind of lead me around the sidewalk, so I'd just fuck off if they didn't do it. When I was getting out of hand, they took me up to the clothesline outside, and I'd run, and I'd just go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, until I'd fall over, and then they'd pick me up and put me back in the room and stay put. And my fear is that the steps were going to be like that. There's going to be more of the harness and the leash, and 1 to 12, 1 to 12, 1 to 12, 1 to 12, and that's going to be my life for the rest of the time when I'm sober. That's a misconception. That's something that's being cleared away, and a different kind of higher power is coming in, and the steps are liberating. It's paradoxical that these 12 steps, and that's it, are going to open up a life of experience and richness. But at that time, my understanding of, I guess, higher power was stay put. I was also told very frequently as a child that you're sickly. There's something wrong with you. We're all sick, because my parents didn't exclude themselves from this. And one of the mantras that I heard, and this has again been a source of issues for me in accepting the program, was the idea of having allergies. In our family, we all had allergies. You were sick. There was a list of things we couldn't eat, a list of things we couldn't do, medical alert bracelets, the whole bit, and once a week, once every 2 weeks from infancy, we had allergy shots. And I remember in our house, it was the antihistamine tablets, like Benadryl, were doled out like hosts and put on our tongue. You know, usually because we were being, you know, hyper or wound up. You know, so the allergies are obviously out of control, so we got to just give them a pill. And so when I first came to the program and heard that alcoholism is an allergy, I bristled. I knew that I had this problem with alcohol, but the thought that it was an allergy infuriated me. The thought that it was a disease, I accepted a little more easily. But I got another allergy? Fuck that. All I need to do is change my diet, work out, you know, and just get away from this propaganda, and things will be okay. So there's been some resistance. The fact is I do have this disease, and it's difficult still for me to use the term, but yeah, I guess I have this allergy as well. How about I just say that I have this disease called alcoholism? One of the other cures that my parents used to give to me in order to help me calm down was what the English call a hot toddy. It might be called by other things in other cultures, but in our home it was called a hot toddy. If you're not sure what hot toddy is hot water for us, lemon juice, a tablespoon of honey, and a shot of whiskey, usually, maybe some other liquor. Stir it all up, put it in front of the afflicted, and after they take a, you know, throw back the mug, they're out. And that's what worked for me. And needless to say, I stayed sick for a long time, so I could have a lot of these hot toddies. I wasn't very old. You know, I was 6, 7, 8. I'd sit in my pajamas at the kitchen table, wait for the tea kettle to go off, and all the triggers were there. And, and then the bottle would come out, you know, and fill it with the whiskey and stir it up. And, you know, all that anticipation. And then the feeling would come, and it was, you know, I'd been conditioned, I think, from a fairly early age that when wound up and sick and things are kicking in, the medicine's there. So the first real drink, you could say, happened when I was 14. My first drink was a drunk, which they say is one indication of a kind of alcoholism. It doesn't have to be the case for everyone, but it's certainly the case for me. As I mentioned before, I play the bagpipes. Well, when I was 14, I had been playing already for a year. And I just joined the local band, which is a Legion band. In Legion bands, the focus tends not to be so much on the music as it is on the drinking. And there were three or four of us in the band who were underage, And we had two sets to play that night. It was a gig. And the pipe major came up to us and said, all right, we've got two sets tonight. First set, I want you all to stay sober. Second set, I don't give a shit. So for the first set, we all played. And it was the break between the sets. And the young lads, or four of us, were downstairs thinking, what do we do? They're all getting drunk. What do we do? We're 15, 14. What do we do? One of the older members of the band obliged us and came down with a can of Coke and said, this is for you. Lads, drink up. And inside was scotch. It was Crown Royal, actually. And there were four of us. The other three kind of took a few sips and did a little dance. And I can remember, as the can got to me, I was the last one having this feeling. They're all kind of watching me to see, you know, how I was going to come at it. The other guys were jocks. They were great athletes. I sucked at sports. They took a, you know, decent-sized drink, but not a massive one. But it came to me in the can, and I just had this feeling. You know, this is something I can do, right? This is something I can do well, you know? And I did. Wow. There you go. Crunch, clone. Let's go. And the transformation happened. I went from being a shy, backwards, you know, awkward, stumbling kind of kid to, you know, suave, I get to talk and shake hands and, you know, chat with the big people, and I can pipe like a motherfucker and all the rest of it. Until, of course, the blackout happened, and I still to this day don't know how the evening ended up. Other than that, I blacked out, was incredibly hungover, and likely puked, which happened a lot when I drank. And that began a pattern. I had a bit of a double life in high school. I felt extremely guarded, like I couldn't expose myself to the people at school, you know, which for a lot of people, or some people, I don't know who these people are, but for some people, school is where they feel they can fit in and find their friends. That was never me. I was guarded and hid myself and ran to my locker into the classroom and maybe played a bit of football, and that was it, and went to the odd dance drunk, you know, and kind of made my appearance there. But my only buddies at the school, there were a couple of them, happened to be the same buddies that I played in this pipe band. So it was like my other existence, kind of like a club life. My club life when I was a teenager was playing with a pipe band, traveling with a pipe band, drinking with a pipe band, partying with a pipe band. I learned, and this was a mantra, it was a principle, a slogan, work hard, play hard. Work hard, play hard. Which meant in that organization, you play, you practice your instrument, you practice like crazy, you set a high standard, you know. Because by this time I was changing bands and moving up the piping ladder, so to speak. And correspondingly, the intensity of the drinking and the partying and creativity that went into it escalated. So I was pretty well behaved in the face of it at school, although my grades weren't good. But I was, you know, didn't seem to get into too much trouble. But I had this summer and weekend and March break kind of life that was becoming a binge lifestyle. So that carried me through to the teens. I managed to squeak into university. I went to a university that's considered still last chance university in Ontario, which is if no other school will take you, this school will, especially if you're prepared to pay the tuition. And I lived in a residence called McDonald Hall, and there was a sister residence, all of her 300 guys in one residence, 10 floors, 30 guys per floor, called McDonald Hall or Mac Hall. Neighboring residence was called Laurier. 10 floors, 30 girls per floor, so it was the girls' residence or women's residence. And each of them was sponsored. We had parties all through the year. In order to have those parties happen, they had to be sponsored. My building was sponsored by Blue. This building was sponsored by Blue Light. Which meant upon arrival, you were given this big tube. You open up the tube, and inside, like where the architects have their plans and stuff, you open it up, and inside, posters, stickers, and stuff of the Blue Girls and you know, Labatt's Blue and Out of the Blue and all that kind of like party stuff. And basically, we all obliged. I think very few people didn't, and you just plastered your walls with this stuff. So, of course, we're going to be loyal to the brand, and we're going to continue to buy the stuff. So we buy the cans in the cartons, and we take the cardboard cartons, cut them out, and use it as wallpaper. So over the course of the year, if you're living in a Labatt Blue environment, or a Blue Light environment, if you're that unlucky, and we were immersed in this stuff. And this residence in this school, I mean, we were from all across Ontario, Canada, and parts of the States. In our respective towns and cities, we were all similar personalities. We were those people who were kind of weird, and our grades sucked, but man, we could party. and you put them all in one place. And the Bats Blue happens to be there. I don't want to turn that into an outside issue, but obviously I have an opinion on it. I was able to keep up appearances for a while, but eventually people started to realize that I was the guy. Like, there was partying, right? And there was partying hard. And Frosch students and students in general can certainly party hard, but I was starting to be the guy who would do it more than the other people. I'd start before everyone and finish before them, usually. And what was especially embarrassing is that I often blacked out, so there are parts of every evening that I didn't know what I did, routinely. And I had a knack for throwing up and in, you know, awkward ways. And, you know, it's one of those things, like I mentioned in an AA meeting, and I think, you know, you're supposed to find that shocking, but I forget I'm in an AA meeting. Of course, drunks aren't going to find that particularly shocking, but I forget sometimes that that's not social behavior. It's not healthy, normal, adjusted behavior to get shit-faced blackout and then puke wherever. You know, when people do that to me now in my life, now I'm like, dude, come on, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, shit, yeah, I used to do that all the time. You know, guys, I know I work with, wake up with puking themselves and all over their beds, or they puke in the cars, they puke in elevators and cabs, and I did all of that. But, you know, that's not healthy behavior. It is funny, but it's not healthy behavior. So that was my thing. So by this time, I won't go into detail about it, but drugs enter the picture. I managed to avoid drugs through my teen years because the particular culture I was connected to, the Scottish culture, prized heavy drinking. But the particular branches of it I was connected to weren't big on the drugs. You know, they drew the line there. Of course, there were probably some people doing coke and whatever, but you could get by just drinking, and that was enough. However, I dropped out of school and decided to go tree planting. And I planted trees for 4 summers, and my life really started to go downhill after here. My bottom, I started to accelerate to my bottom. For those who aren't aware, tree planting is one of those, what time is it?
24.
Okay. Yep, yeah, I'm on schedule. Tree planting is a classic job for 20-something Canadian youths and aging hippies and ex-cons to take part in. And what you do is you go to remote areas of Canada, Northern Ontario, Manitoba, Alberta, BC. And for certain months out of the year, you help with the reforestation of Canada's north, cutting trees down by the acre for toothpicks and Kleenex and whatever. They want to put trees back in. So they hire us to do this kind of, you know, a kind of it was labor, basically, and plant trees. The job in itself, you're just putting trees into the ground, and that's it. You put a couple thousand in a day, and you're paid, you know, piecework. But the social life and the culture connected to it is sex, drugs, and rock and roll. You're isolated. You're making a lot of money fast. You're usually getting into pretty good shape so your body can withstand a lot of abuse. I mean, you're working 10, 12-hour days, carrying 40 pounds in all kinds of weather, and you're moving, moving, moving all day. So on the weekends and days off, when it's time to party, you can party. You know, you're like, you're in the shape of a triathlete kind of thing. You can just go. So the only thing that satisfies is the binge. The jobs, the contracts last a month or two at a time, so you've got, you know, early summer you work, the rest of the summer you got off, and you got a stack of cash. You can make a lot of money. So it's perfect for an addict and an alcoholic. And there's no cops up there and whatever. So I fell right into it. I started to identify as a tree planter, read, party animal. And school, forget school, I just ran from that screaming. And I finally started to discover a lifestyle that I considered to be cool. I'm finally making it. I didn't realize that had been my goal, but my goal had been, I want to be cool. When I had those Labatt's Blue posters and the Out of the Blue, I thought, yeah, I want to be Out of the Blue. There's a party I see in the commercials. I want to be there. But I could never find it. Now tree planting, drinking, binge drinking, drugging, all the rest of it, I felt like I was starting to be cool. Unfortunately, what seemed to be part of that whole scene, at least the part of the scene that I got connected to, was itineraries or homelessness. In the summer, you know, some guys just, you know, don't have a place to stay, so you sleep in the park and you party and you crash at friends' places, whatever. No big deal. But when that starts to persist, in the off-season, then there's a problem. My drinking and drug me led me there. fairly young, early 20s when it really started. Those only times when I wasn't homeless were those occasions when I was when I had a girlfriend, and I would use women terribly. I mean, a lot of my amends involved making amends to former girlfriends who I used for a place to stay, food, clothes, network of friends, liquor, drugs, sex, you name it. And once I was done with them, I tossed them aside and demand another situation like that. And if it wasn't forthcoming, fuck it, I'll just party and wait for the next tree planting season. So when I ran out of girlfriends and couches to sleep on, that's when the Salvation Army became a regular stop for me. The one bridge that I hadn't burned, which is a kind of classic last bridge to burn for someone like me, was the bridge that Mom was preserving. Mom saved me every time. My father had written me off by this point. No son of mine. My dad was a cop, remember, 30 years. He knew what I was becoming. And he realized, too, I think, in his own way, there's nothing we can do. He doesn't want help. Gotta let him go. But my mom insisted, and I used that insistence. Whether she was enabling me, that's what it was. So I went back to them, to their place. They were living in Ontario, with my tail between my legs, and became in this small town, and it's kind of a affluent town. I don't come from affluence, but my dad was a policeman in this affluent town. Became a noisy, obnoxious drunk in this town. So the decor may have changed. You know, there were swankier pubs and little, like, drinking nests that I was drinking in, but I was still getting shit-faced and puking and making an ass out of myself. So changing places obviously didn't make a difference. So what happened? I had been off in and out of the streets in my late 20s, couldn't keep a job, had a habit, could have kept going. Two things happened that led me to the rooms. One, during the years that I was homeless and tree planting, I had a buddy. Drinking buddy, using buddy. His name was Jeff S. And I had written him off. I thought, you know, this guy was even worse than me, and I thought, I love this guy, and I really did love this guy, but he just wasn't stopping, and I was lamenting. I remember grieving over this guy and our friendship. You know, one of the reasons I felt I had an excuse not to work and not to be a success is because my best buddy, my using buddy, isn't surviving. He's dying. Committing suicide slowly. So, what was me? I get a phone call from this guy, long distance out of the blue one day when I'm in the middle of my shit. You know that stuff that goes on when you're in your shit? I'm in the middle of that, flies buzzing around me, and I get this phone call from Jeff. And Jeff says, hey man, how's it going? Say, oh man, how are you? I haven't heard from you. Ages, how you doing? Pretty good. I'm sober. And it just, like, it hit me. I'm like, this, the last guy you'd expect to be sober. He says, yeah, I've been without a drink or a drug for almost 2 years. What? Yeah, I'm in NA, I'm in AA, and I do these fellowships. And one of the things I have to do to stay sober is make amends. So I'm apologizing to you. I used you and abused you and made you drink and drug more than you wanted to and treated you really poorly. And I said, oh, man, it was my fault. He says, no, I forced a lot of it on you, and I'm sorry for that. And the feeling kind of burned through the flies buzzing and the shit. And there was this peace and this light. And I think I was in a kind of spiritual shock. It was a spiritual, like, right hook. And I was dazed. I remember hanging up and going, my God, the last person you'd ever expect is sober. And there was hope. Now, it wasn't enough for me to come to AA, but I believe it planted a seed. Because I did care about the guy. And hearing that he was getting better did my heart good. And hearing the amend did my heart good as well. So what happened? Well, as I said, I couldn't keep a job in the town, this community. I had been doing some acting, and I was considered to be somebody with some talent, but man, that drinking problem really sucks. So they gave me a job. This was November, December, just before the ice storm, and they said, okay, we want you to be the coordinator of a new youth drop-in center for this town. And we want, in January, you're going to start up. And I'm like, you mean me? can't keep my shit together. No, we think you're the person for the job. Oh, we're not starting until January, as we said, but over Christmas, you're going to need to keep in contact with two people, the chair of the committee that runs this place and the finance person. They're both going to be available for you. And I thought, finance person? Oh, okay. Maybe I can get an advance or something. So I called the finance person, Pat D. And she says, well, hey, are you busy tonight? You know, why don't you come over for dinner? And Pat was one of those people who had an apartment downtown, single mom, who kids could drop over anytime. She always had a pot of chili in the stove, and open door policy. They'd clean the dishes, drop a couple of dollars if they had it, and if they needed to get away, away from the gang, away from the parents, away from whatever, from the craziness, they could come there for some peace and some warmth and a good meal. And I thought, this is fabulous. And I sit down on the kitchen table, and I'm still in that kind of like south kind of space. And as I sit down at the kitchen table, there's a copy of that book on the table. And it was, again, it was one of those moments where I believe, almost under, oh, I believe my higher power was touched me. And my normal reaction in the past when I had brief contact with AA would have been to run away. Fuck this, these people are crazy and I do not have a problem, thank you very much. Classic response, right? Something, some grace, some higher power fueled moment had me say, that's the AA book, right? She said, yes. I said, are you on? She said, yes. I said, I think I need to go to a meeting. She said, no problem. Next night was all arranged, the car picked me up, and I'm in the back, curled up, in pain, being brought to a meeting. The car was filled with laughing, warm, joking people. They had their arms around each other. The car was packed. Nobody seemed to care. 20-minute drive to the next meeting in the next town. Excuse me. And I went to my first meeting, 14th of January, 1998. And I heard at that meeting a share that was remarkably like mine. Now, I was 27 at the time, fairly young. And yeah, I'd experienced a certain amount of tough times as a result of alcohol, but my bottom could have been much, much deeper. And I heard a share that night from someone whose story, like I said, it was like they did their homework or something. It was my story. Up until the moment where I was in that chair at that moment in that meeting, and this guy's story kept going for another 17 fucking years of hell that kept getting worse and worse. And right when you think you can't get any worse, it got worse. Electroshock and jail and madness and losing family and job and hell. I remember just feeling this, oh my God, I can't let that happen to me. And I attribute that as one of those instances where in the 12 and 12 they mention where some of us whose bottoms are a little younger, maybe our bottoms are a little higher, can have it dropped thanks to old timers sharing their experience with us. Don't do what I did. Stop now. So I went home and I had a bottle of wine and drank for 4 more days. And again, a seed had been planted, and I think between that ninth step call that I'd received and a glimpse of AA, I thought, this is it. I have to go back. And with the grace of God, I haven't had a drink since January 18th, 1998. I would so love to be able to say that it's been golden flowers and bliss since that time, in those 8 years, but it hasn't. However, I can honestly say that those first 3 months, I experienced the honeymoon. That was wonderful. It was, if you didn't, you know, January, February, March, April, like into April, my first sober spring as an adult. I was amazed. I could hear the birds and the flowers. I loved it. I got active in service right away. For some reason, service wasn't a problem. The thought of, you know, setting up chairs, making coffee. I wasn't comfortable interacting with people very much. Steps were still seemed like another language to me, but service I got into right away. Sponsorship, however, was a problem for me. I realized part of there was two reasons for that, I think. One is that perhaps my bottom wasn't as intense as it could have been, and I all too easily said, you're not working for me next, you're not working for me next. The other thing, too, is that I was still closeted at the time. And I happened to be gay, but and I think that's relevant for me in terms of my recovery, because I was in complete denial about something central to myself. And it's very difficult to practice the steps or relate to people when you're just in denial about a fundamental part of you. I did the best I could. I do believe it was the steps ultimately that helped me get in touch with that part of myself and make this coming up process easier. But at that time, I did the best I could. And because the streets had been so familiar to me, I experienced 2 more bouts of homelessness. Why? I believe it's because I hadn't done the steps, didn't have a sponsor, I stopped going to meetings, wasn't reading literature, etc. I was convinced, though, I wasn't supposed to drink, so I wasn't drinking. I was on the streets, sober. I don't recommend it. There's nothing to block the pain of the experience. But what finally brought me around, finally, to the program, the first 2 years it was kind of off and on, you know, and I did have a group for a while, hadn't done the steps. I came to Montreal, and as I mentioned, that was almost 6 years ago at this time. And I believe that Montreal was where my higher power wanted me to be. And by coming to that place, I was able to start to practice the program and do the things I was meant to do, as I was meant to do them. Might sound strange, but I think my higher power is that geographically specific. I needed to be here for things to work for me. What finally got me into the steps was one of these 12-step groups, these workshops, where, granted, it's not an official AA meeting, but I committed to a sponsor, attended 16 weeks every Monday for 2 hours with the same group of guys. Well, we started out 16, but we dropped down to about 10. 6 people dropped out. A lot of them weren't drinking again. And I was committed not to let that happen to me. So I prayed and said, God, get me through the steps, please. So my sponsor at the time, Mick G, God bless him, he's fantastic, helped me with my 5th. I was not ready to share my stuff. I was terrified. My guards were up. But he was all too willing. And he has an interesting past and a pretty rough one, and he was completely open about it. And the openness that he had in his 5th unclogged, it broke some of the dams that I had that were keeping me from doing this. And the stuff just came flowing out as best as it was able at the time. The first level of sludge kind of... And that was when I discovered, I believe, I first experienced a deep, lasting glimpse of what sobriety can be like. For the month after, the first few days after I did my 5th, I felt a lot of remorse because I couldn't believe that I'd been such an asshole for so long and I'd been behaving that way. However, something buoyed me up, and for the next 3 weeks, I was on a spiritual high. I could feel that relief. I could feel that release, the forgiveness of self, forgiveness of other people, letting go of resentments. I was beginning to understand how I was hurting by hating other people. And it becomes such an automatic trigger, you know, mechanism inside to resent other people. And I'm going to do you in, boy. Feeling that resentment, I was the one who suffered. And realizing that there's other ways of doing things. My God, it was an inner revolution as far as my inner life goes. You know, the skies opened and the rain fell. Thank God. I served as a GSR for a few meetings, and I did fairly well by AA, or AA did well by me, or however you want to put it, up until about my year 5 or 6. And I remember an old-timer coming up to me and saying, look, you're coming up to a danger point. A lot of people, they get some years under their belt, they do the steps a few times, they experience sobriety, changes in their life for the better, all which was happening, the promises were coming true. Active in service, GSR, all that kind of stuff. Ooh. Meetings, fellowship, as much as I was able. And he said, people get to that point and they go, is that all there is? I've got this figured out. I don't want to be hooked up with the leash and the chain and running back and forth for the rest of my life. So I started to distance myself. Stopped going to meetings so much, if at all. Once, twice a month meeting. I'd have sponsors, which I'd never call. Stopped doing the steps, stopped praying. Did I drink? No, by the grace of God. But for almost 2 years, and I'm just coming out of it in the last couple of months, I believe, I distanced myself, rebelled, and the pain returned. This is a program where there's this, I will remain, how is it worded again? I'll remain sober. My sobriety is contingent on the maintenance of a spiritual program daily. Basically, I got to work the program every day if I want to stay sober. I may have almost 8 years, but it ain't worth nothing if I'm not working the program. I almost lost those 8 years. Now, I don't blame myself, and I'm realizing that what I was told was absolutely true. I would have liked to have heard that advice and said, you're right, I'm not going to let that happen to me, and stuck with it. But I needed to experience that. I'm going to back away a little bit and see what happens. And it hurt a lot. Part of what's scary is that I started to feel like things are never going to get better again. And you know what? It hasn't taken long. It's been a few months back in the program, a few months back going to 3 or 4 meetings a week, back connecting with a sponsor. And I think part of what's happened is that I wasn't ready to let... I had had a certain understanding of the program and the feeling of what sobriety was about, and I thought, well, this is what it's going to be. This is what it is. No changes, thank you. When changes started to happen, I assumed they were for the worse, when in fact what seems to be happening is things are getting better. And what better means is not making more money or more degrees or whatever. Feeling. It's a deeper feeling. I'm feeling gratitude more deeply. It was payday last Thursday, and I have had problems with cash and sobriety where I just spend my money, don't save it. And it's affected my sobriety. I was going into a store to buy some much-needed clothes, and as I'm going in, my higher power says to me inside, you have a disease. And it was just this feeling of, I have a disease, and that's a good thing. So I was able to make the purchases that I needed within reason and put the bank card and the credit card back in the wallet and did things in measure, good orderly direction. So that was a first step moment. I've had an understanding of the first step from the beginning of my experience in AA, but that experience then and this experience of a few days ago were not the same. And I would say one of the reasons they're different is this one's a little deeper. Felt it more deeply, and it was a relief. It wasn't shame that I'm an alcoholic. It was, yeah, I got a disease. I'm sick. Yeah, of course. Yeah. And it ain't that there's no cure. There's no cure. Oh, that's good. That's good. Yeah, okay. No cure. I've got it forever. Okay, that's what I needed to hear and feel. And I'm feeling one of the biggest gifts this time around that I can feel, and as I'm feeling more connected to myself, is the connection with fellowship, the people in AA. That's a lot of it's what it's about, I think. Service is connection to people. Steps are to help me relate to people, be of service to people. I was trying to do all that without the people. You are AA. You've helped me stay sober. You've helped me understand my higher power. You're the people that I love. You're my people. And are a good reason to stay sober. You know? And I'm very grateful for it. So... I thank you very much for the chance to share. I wish you a happy 24 and hope to see you next week.